Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Boil vegetables on the stove? No way. You want to boil some vegetables? Just go straight to your kitchen tap. 100 degree boiling hot water straight on your peas. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. I love mine, and thank you to Cooker for sponsoring the podcast. And thank you for listening. These podcasts are coming thick and fast at the moment. I might have to slow down a bit, actually. Do enjoy talking to people, and hopefully you enjoy listening to them too. So for today's hour, I will be asking 15 questions to Denise Van Outen. When you look at what she's done, when you look at her CV, it is really impressive. She has been in showbiz all her life. She was in bands as a kid. She presented The Big Breakfast, as everybody knows. There are too many acting credits to list. They include EastEnders and many West End musicals. I always think one of the standout things for Denise, though, in her career is when Andrew Lloyd Webber's one-man show, Tell Me on a Sunday, she did that, and she did he did a rework of it for her, and it was just a massive success for her, and it ran for like a year or so. I mean, just incredible to be on the stage on your own. Yeah, you have to have a talent to be able to do that. Yeah, you're not just going to be able to stand up there unless you've got all the ability in the world. Right, let's have a chat with her. Here's Denise Van Outen. Hello, Denise. Thank you for joining me on the podcast. How
Very
are you?
Excited to talk to you again. It's always lovely to hear your voice.
I was just saying in the intro about your one woman show with Andrew Lloyd Webber. An incredible thing to do, isn't it? That.
Do you know what? I think looking back, as you get older and you look back at your career, there are certain things you really appreciate. And I think what I appreciate the most about that time when I did that was, I don't think I realised how lucky I was when I actually lived in Andrew's house for 3 to 4 months, and he wrote that show around me. So I was there throughout the whole process. And I don't really know any other artist performer that's had that experience of actually having a show pretty much written for them. So all the references in the show, a lot of it is obviously they're his songs and they already pre-existed, but the storyline and the thread throughout the show is based very loosely, but on my life and on me as a person. So what's quite amazing for me is, because when I went to theatre school when I was a kid, you know, and I used to go for auditions, I would sing, you know, maybe a song from Les Mis or an Andrew Lloyd Webber Phantom of the Opera song. But I've actually got young actors that message me on social media to say that they sing my songs for auditions. And that's quite weird, because it's just like, well, first of all, it makes me feel really old. And then secondly, I feel quite proud. And I just think how amazing to work with someone like him and actually be there throughout the whole creative process.
Why were you living with him?
Because the show itself was originally, it was only a 15-minute piece. And then he wanted to turn it into a full production. And this came off the back of him hearing me sing at the Royal Variety Performance. And he said, oh, I want to write a one-woman show for you. It was just such a long process. I mean, Andrew will tell you he can never switch off from music. He constantly hears music in his head. So he would just come up with ideas and songs and you know, just different storylines. And Don Black is the lyricist on the show. Andrew did the music. If you can hear a funny noise in the background, that's just my dog, by the way, drinking water.
Okay, that's cool.
It sounds quite rude, but it's not, I can assure you. Nothing untoward here. So I lived with him just purely because it would have meant commuting every day to him from Sidmonton, his house in the country, which is amazing. And we literally worked on it from morning, noon and night, just creating this show. And the first time I showcased it was in, he's got his own theatre in a little chapel on his land, on the grounds of his house. And my audience was the cream of like West End Broadway. I mean, they were all there. I had like Cameron McIntosh watching me.
Wow.
Yeah, it was insane.
Going back to Andrew Lloyd Webber, right? Yeah. The only thing I know about Andrew Lloyd Webber is that he's got swimming cats. And I always remember reading that he has swimming cats and thought, where do they swim? Did you ever see his cat swimming?
No cats. No.
What?
No swimming cats. Not in his country house. Andrew has got a few different houses.
Right.
So I've stayed in Andrew's house in the country. The dog's just dropped a bone. House in the country. I've stayed his house in London, which is beautiful. And he's placed in New York as well.
Cool. Good player.
So me and Andrew are like Bezzy's mate, you know?
It must be amazing, though, when someone like Andrew Lloyd Webber says, I heard you sing and I want to build a show around you.
Well, do you know what? At first, I thought it was a bit of a joke because he said to me, he came to see Tell Me On the Raw Variety Performance, and I was singing Take That Look Off Your Face from Tell Me On a Sunday, and it wasn't planned. It was just the producer said, can you sing this song? And I knew it from when Marty Webb did it in the 70s because my mum used to play it. I sang it, and then Andrew came to see me afterwards, and then he was like, oh, would you like to come to my house for dinner? I had no idea you could sing like this, and I'd love to work with you. So I went to his house, and then he just started playing the piano, and he was like, sing for me. And I thought, you know, when it's that really awkward moment, and you're just thinking, well, I don't even know what to sing, you know? And then he started getting me to sing Take That Look Off Your Face. And then he was singing other lyrics and melodies to me, and I was just singing them back to him. And they were all songs from the show. So it was almost like he'd got me there for an audition.
Oh, wow.
But hadn't told me it was an audition. And then the next thing he said, how do you fancy doing your own one-woman show? And I was like, yeah, okay. I don't think I was really taking into consideration what was involved. And I just went, yeah, I'd love to. And then the next thing, I'm living in his house. I've got Andrew composing around me. Don Black, who's obviously, you know, he's won an Oscar, and he was there doing all the lyrics. And it was quite a mad experience. And like I said, it's only when I look back now that I realised how lucky I am to have had that experience as well. And also, on top of all of it, Andrew took me to choose my own theatre to perform in.
That's amazing.
So he took me out for dinner. We went to the Ivy, which was one of Andrew's favourites. And he said, I've got a surprise for you this evening. I said, what? And he said, I think wherever you do this show, because you're going to be on your own, I want you to be really comfortable. So Andrew's driver... he's got a driver that drives a black taxi. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but goes around London in a black taxi to avoid traffic. And he said, my cab driver's outside and we're going to do a little tour of the West End and go to all of my theatres that I own, and you can choose a theatre. Wow. So we went to the Drury Lane, which when I got there, I thought was too big. And I was like, it's not going to work here. And then when we got to the Gielgud, there was a play on at the time. And I walked in and I just thought, this has got a nice intimate feel to it. And I said, yeah, I like this one. He went, it's yours.
Wow. That's
so I chose my theatre. And then doing the show every day, originally I was only supposed to do it for about 6 weeks, and it kept selling out and selling out. And I ended up doing it for 10 months on my own until I was completely worn out and said, I can't really carry on because it's so draining. I'd been there, you know, 8 shows a week.
Right, Denise, the idea of this is I'm going to ask you 15 questions. We'll never get through them all. I reckon we'll get through about 4 or 5, but we've got to try and keep it within an hour. So
yeah, I can't try and keep my answer short.
No, you don't have to. Right, let's start with the first one. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Never be afraid to say yes to anything that you're scared of, but like be fearless, because I think I've had such a varied career and I put it down to the fact that I say yes to things, and I just think everything, every challenge, every opportunity will bring something to you, you know, even if it doesn't go ahead to plan. Like even that, my failures, I've got something out of it. Like I've done some really terrible jobs, you know, I've done films that have just bombed and been absolute turkeys, literally been sitting there in a cinema, you know, trying to cover my embarrassment. But you always learn something. And I'm not, perhaps it's sometimes to my own detriment, but I'm not particularly fussy. Do you know what I mean? I just always look at things and think, first of all, will I enjoy it? Will I learn something from this? Then I'll do it.
Do you know
what? I'm not scared of failure in a way. I don't care.
I was looking at your CV today and you've done so many different things. And what I thought was amazing is I'm completely the opposite to you. I just turn stuff down all the time because I think, oh, I'm not sure I want to do that. Oh, I'm not sure. And I always think, well, why am I not doing it? And I look at your CV and I think, you've just done everything. You've just gone for it and done it. And I wish maybe I should be a bit more, a bit more accepting of the fact that I will maybe do some turkeys. I was just looking at your reality.
You know what people forget as well, Tim, that's the thing. I've done things and I've been absolutely panned by the critics, but people do forget. And we have a tendency to over, not just in the industry that we're in, but in every job or every aspect of life, where we overthink things and worry too much what people think. But do people really care? In that moment, like the amount of times I've had bad reviews from a journalist, But then 2 weeks later, I've had five people at a stage door saying that they loved the show or performance. And that means more to me. But, you know, you could, it holds you back in life. Yeah. So I just, you've got to learn not, you just care less.
All right, I'm going to start saying yes to things. What's the best moment of your career, Denise?
Well, this is a tough one because I suppose it depends what I've done at different times. But I suppose a bucket list thing for me probably as a kid, because I always loved wanting to do shows, was to be on Broadway doing Chicago. That was quite amazing. And the time when I did it as well, I look back and it was a really special time in my life. I felt like I really needed it in my life. And I realise again that I'm very lucky to have had that experience.
Yeah. And I suppose it's one of those things that's why you went to school to learn to sing and dance and act. And then when you bring them all together on the stage, don't you? And I think that's one of the things that sets proper entertainers apart from people like me, monkeys who just can't do it.
People always assume that I absolutely love musicals, and the truth is I don't.
Right.
That's the only thing I will say. When it comes to a musical, I'm quite fussy. I don't like the very old-fashioned, fuddy-duddy ones. I just like ones that are a little bit core, a little bit different. So I'm not a lover of your traditional musical, you know. I don't like the cheesy ones. I like them. I mean, if you look at the shows that I've done, the Chicago, it's sexy. Rent's quite, it's a cool musical. Legally Blonde's just really funny. I did it with Sheridan. My one woman show is obviously a really nice piece of theatre, and it's an acting role. So I haven't done like the really cheesy ones. Like, I don't think you would see me dressed up, for instance, as like a lioness in The Lion King.
Was there any time in that one woman show, that any of those 10 months, where you got on stage and thought, whoa, I'm not feeling this today?
Yeah, you get that. And I remember once, I had a little bit of an anxiety attack, just purely because it's weird when you act, and it sounds really pretentious, but when you're acting, you have to get right into the character, and sometimes you just can't get in it for whatever reason, you know, and you're sort of outside of yourself. And I remember one show I came off, and it was only me and a band and my stage manager, and I came off and I went, I feel really self-conscious. And she was like, you're absolutely fine. Honestly, your performance is the same as it was last night. You're overthinking it. And I said, yeah, but I just feel like they're all looking at me. And she went, well, what do you expect them to do? But I was trying to explain to her, I meant they were sort of, I could feel them looking at me. It was a different feeling to normal. I couldn't, whereas normally I'd switch off from the audience.
Right, I see.
Yeah, it's weird.
All right, we've done what's the best moment of your career. What's the worst moment of your career?
I've had a few bad moments, probably work-wise. I mean, I wouldn't say, like, you know, it's not because of anything that I've not enjoyed jobs, because I've always enjoyed most things that I've done. But I'd say probably in terms of, like, proper turkey, that's got a turkey, it's got a badge on it and everything, was when I did a film called Run For Your Wife with Danny Dyer and the lovely Sarah Harding. And it was just terrible. And I remember they did this huge, big Leicester Square premiere that, you know, made such a fuss about it. And it was just a really bad film. I don't think I've even watched it since. I watched it once that night. And my agent at the time, my acting agent, I looked at her and she sort of, no, people weren't even clapping at the end of the film. It was a bit like, where's the bowl? And it was really awkward. It was like this kind of... And I was sort of waiting for people to say, oh, well done, or, you know, oh, considering, you know, it was low budget, it was quite a good film. And I just turned to my agent at the time and I said, what did you think? And she went, it's terrible. And then I thought she was going to say to me, but you were good in it. And she just went to me, and you're not good in this. And I just sat there and I went, okay. And I said, well, you know, maybe it's because, you know, the director that we had is lovely. He's used to directing stage performances, so everything was all over the top. Because it was a bit of a slapstick comedy. And she said, no, I don't think it was the direction. She said, it's just not good. And I just thought, thanks. And yeah, that was really bad. And it was panned by the critics. And to the point of, I think, the Sun newspaper a week later, because it only had like one cinema release, was in the cinema for about 2 days, and then it got pulled because it sold no tickets. And then about a week later, someone had sent a picture of the DVD had just been released as well, of it in a bargain bucket for like $2.99 or something, and posted it on social media. And I was just like, I just want this one to go away. And to make it even worse, was Danny Dyer like massively threw me and Sarah Harding under the bus. Because obviously where he'd done this film, and he was like, we weren't considered to be actors. So for us, it was like, well, it doesn't really affect our career. We're still working. Because he'd got panned by the critics. He then used us as the excuse for the film not being good by saying, you know, they weren't taking it very seriously. They don't have the same passion for acting that I've got. And it was like, listen, mate, you're just shitting it. Just don't try to blame the two blonde women in your life, you know, to say that that's why you were so bad. Your performance was terrible.
What was the long-term impact of that? Is there, or is it just a short-term?
Yeah, it does. I mean, this is where I probably fall down, because perhaps I should be more choosy, because you do something like that and then other things that I want to go for, other parts, I wouldn't be considered a good actress because, you know, I've just done a massive turkey.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really bother me. Like I said, at the time, I had a brilliant time. The film was fun, made some friends, and, you know, got, not only did I get panned by the critics, I got panned by Danny Dyer, of all people, who plays himself in everything he does.
All right, next question. What does success mean to you?
It depends what you, the measure of success, what it is. I don't go seeking it. My personal, what I get out of something personally is how I measure success for me. Do you know what I mean? What I get out of a job and the friendships that I make. And I'm clearly not that bothered about whether or not I'm sort of flavour of the month. It doesn't bother me at all.
What do you think people know you most for?
Well, it's interesting because cab drivers, black taxi drivers in London seem to think I'm still in Chicago. I get in, they go, you still in that show? And it's like, well, I did that in 2001. Or I get introduced quite often as the voice of The Only Way Is Essex. And then I look at my CV and it makes me laugh. And I think, well, you know, I don't know, really. I think people of our age group, the middle-aged lot, Tim. Yeah. Probably Big Breakfast.
Yeah, definitely. Whenever I think about
which
you,
I'm very
proud
of, and I love it, and I still reminisce. And you know, we've still got the same group friends from the show from old. So I loved my time on the show, and that's probably one of my favourite things that I've ever worked on.
It had two incarnations. It had the first one with Chris and Gabby, which was amazing, the one I worked on, and then you and Johnny was just, I mean, it was a bit weird in between, but you and Johnny were just absolutely incredible. Those two pairings,
yeah,
perfect, weren't they? But I always remember that you started it in a helicopter.
I've still got my original contract.
That lasted for about a month, didn't it, where you were in a helicopter?
No, I did 6 weeks. So I've got the contract, the Planet 24 contract, on the most terrible money. I mean, you know, you couldn't even feed your dog with what I was being paid. But it was 6 weeks. I should frame it, actually. It'd be a nice one to put up in the toilet. But, yeah, it's my six-week Planet 24 contract to be a weather girl. And then when the contract ended, I was meant to just leave. But then suddenly Rick Adams, who was in the show at the time, Sharon Davis, wasn't working with them on screen. And it was actually Gary Bushell at The Sun who started a campaign in The Sun newspaper to get the weather girl, I didn't even have a name, typical Gary Bushell, the blonde weather girl, into the house. And that's how it all started. And it was The Sun.
And I found this a lot in my time in TV, that the only way a show like that really works is if you give all the power to the presenters. And I think often what happens is the production want to retain the power and think of all the ideas and have the personality. And until you give it, I mean, I remember after Chris Evans left, because he was so powerful and I was still at the Big Breakfast, they never wanted to let that situation happen again where they gave all the presenter one power. And so they were very much keeping the presenters down. And I think that when it worked again was when they said to you and Johnny, well, I don't think that anyone could control you and Johnny, could they? You went live and just went, we'll do what the hell we want. And that's what makes the show brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to find telly like it now, where you just have that freedom. when I even look at like what I used to wear on it, I mean, I used to dress like I was going to a nightclub, so, you know, at 7 in the morning, but it was brilliant. And, you know, I do sometimes wish telly could be a bit more like it, just a bit more relaxed and fun. And
Sunday brunch does that though, doesn't it, Denise?
Sunday brunch, but it's only on one day.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just think in the mornings, you just, it would be nice. Because the thing is, we had, like, kids used to watch it as well as adults. So you had, you know, it's hard to find a show like that now, that you people of all ages, and to have the freedom. But it was very much of the time.
Definitely was. Right, next question. What's your outstanding fashion moment? There you go. You're just talking about it.
Okay, well, I can give you this one exactly. Relatable to the Big Breakfast was probably when I went to the Brits with Johnny Vaughan and I wore a blue rubber dress. Don't know if you remember it, very high ponytail, and it went everywhere in the press and I had to be cut out of the dress. And, it was made by, I can't even remember the name of the designer who made it, but it was rubber and it was so skin tight, obviously. And then I remember when I got home, I had to get someone to cut me out the dress so that I could get to sleep. And also Vivian Westwood, and I've still got them here, she made me, because obviously being a very typical Essex girl, she made me a pair of white stilettos and I've still got them.
Do you know, it's really weird. I've said this a few times on my podcast. I've actually said it on Sunday brunch as well, that whenever I present with a woman, they just get absolutely hammered about their looks all the time. Whereas I can kind of go on pretty much how I want. And I'll get a couple of people tell me I'm ugly or look old or whatever it is. But I don't, the women get so much more scrutiny over everything, the way they look. But then I suppose the other side of it is you can do that, go in a rubber dress, and then that all change the people's perception of you immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I could then. I wouldn't do it now. but yeah, I did then. And again, just didn't really care what people thought. You know, I was only young really when I did the show. I was like 20, 24, 23 when I started. 24, I was young. I had the body to carry the rubber. I wouldn't do it now. But I never really, I mean, I sort of was a little bit, my outfits for morning breakfast TV were slightly outrageous at times, but again, it was the Big Breakfast. You know, I was following in the footsteps of Paula Yates, you know, who was obviously quite, well, very outgoing, and the way she dressed as well, quite flamboyant. So I was all right. I could get away with it.
Yeah, that time in the 90s, it was really, let's push the boundaries as much as we possibly can, wasn't it? It was a real time of that. And Planet 24, the production company which made it, also made The Word, and they were just trying to push the boundaries constantly. And that was sort of our remit, really, wasn't it? Whenever we were working on those sort of things, push as hard as you can, push against. It wasn't called Ofcon then. I can't remember what it was called in those days, but it was like push as much as you can to see how far we can take content. Yeah,
I mean, even to the point, I remember once when I was in the helicopter, they were just like, they said to me before we went live, can you do something outrageous? Because obviously at the time you never had phones and social media. It was more, you know, if you got in the papers, then it was just building the profile of the show. And they knew that I mean, I am still the sort of person that if you dare me to do something, I'll just do it. and I always have been like that. And they just said to me, can you please try and do something outrageous? And I had John Prescott in the helicopter with me as my guest. And I remember I just dived on top of him and started like trying to snog him. And like it made all the press. And it was like, when I think now, you just couldn't do anything like that. Can you imagine Susanna Reeve like diving on top of John Prescott on GMB?
Why was John Prescott in the helicopter doing the weather?
I don't even know. I just know that we picked him up. I used to fly around and I'd have a guest. And it was John Prescott. And like all my mates after was going, how could you? And I was just like, straddled him and tried to snog him.
Oh,
clearly God. Not very fussy at the time.
Times were different back then. All right. Tell our listeners something that has been life changing for you.
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk about one of my friends, actually, that I lost. It's a nice story, by the way. But I did lose her about 3 years ago. And my friend was she was my old PT instructor. I never used to be one for exercise. But I don't know if you remember after I did the Big Breakfast and everything, I reunited with Johnny to do the Capital Breakfast show.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a great time in my life. I had quite a lot of going on in my life that like personal situations. And I've never suffered with depression, but I think it was the only time in my life that I ever got to a point where I was not feeling myself and feeling really quite low. And I remember my friend Nikki, I can name her, she used to live around the corner from me in Hampstead. And she saw me once in Hampstead and she went, "You look terrible." And I said to her, "You know, I'm doing the breakfast show." Now you'll understand this, Tim. I was leaving like in the morning when it was dark. Then I would go on to do another job. I was basically doing too much. And then I'd get home and it was dark. So I wasn't getting any daylight, any fresh air, any sunlight. And I think I did go into a depression. And she just said to me, "Right, this is all going to change. You need every day now for the rest of your life, doesn't matter where you are, what you're doing, you've got to make sure at least half an hour a day you go for a walk and you get outside." And I've always done it. And I think it has always, I don't know what it is, but mentally, physically, it's just, it makes me feel so much better. And I think she kind of made me do it. Mm. And I'm always very grateful for that advice, because I think especially when we went into this lockdown, and it was obviously for a lot of people, it's really hard, but just forcing yourself to get up and go out and go for a walk to clear your head. I mean, when I say that, you leave your phone and everything at home, you just go for a walk and be at one with your thoughts.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that's a good idea on this podcast, but also a lot of the celebrities have said, which is interesting, is that, and I know I used to suffer from this, is I was too scared not to take jobs that I wanted because I always thought it was going to run out at some stage. So I ended up at one stage, you saying you're working hard there. I was doing radio shows, soccer AM, columns. I just didn't have enough time in the day to do it all. But I was like, just say yes to the next thing. You know, XFM want me. I'll have that. And I just kept doing it. And eventually you get worn out, don't you, from it? Or did you have that where you're worried about it?
You do. I mean, I'm still a little bit like that because I like to be really busy, but I've got to know myself better, because my daughter's been diagnosed with ADHD, and because she's had loads of tests because she was struggling to focus at school, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, for ages I kept saying she's got that from her dad, because Lee obviously has, he had learning problems at school, he had dyslexia, but the more she was going for all these tests and seeing specialists, I was going, actually, that's me. And I'm sort of self-diagnosed, but I'm definitely got ADHD, and I think that's part of I can't switch off, and I'm always doing something. It's probably why I've had such a varied career and done so many different things. But I'm glad that I know that about myself now. I wish I'd known years ago, because it affected all my relationships as well. I mean, up until Eddie, I'd never gone out with anyone past 3 years.
Right.
It was a running joke with my friends, because it'd get to like the third year and they'd be like, "So how's it going?" I'm going, "Oh, I'm getting bored now." And I couldn't stay in a relationship because I'd literally want to be moving on, and it's got to be different. And, you know, and this, I mean, it sounds like to a lot of people, you know, like I've lead an extravagant life because I'm always moving around and being here, there and everywhere at times. But it's because I have to for my own sanity. I can't be stuck in one place.
Yeah.
I can't even go on holiday. Right? You know, when people go on holiday, yeah. I've got mates, they take their kids for the whole 6 week summer holiday. That would be like hell for me to be in one place for 6 weeks.
I agree.
I can't even do, if I go on a holiday, I go for a week and then I'm done. I don't even think I've done a 2 week holiday.
I'm exactly the same. I generally go away on a Sunday after a Sunday brunch. I come back on a Saturday, then I don't miss the show. And everyone goes, why'd you do that? And I say, because I really like doing my show. Yeah. I just really like doing it. So
exactly. If you love the job you're doing, why, you know, and you don't want anyone else to step into your place.
Do you know what? Honestly, it's not so much that. It's just I would always, whenever I do take weeks off, I'm always sitting there thinking, I get to the Sunday, I think I'd rather be on the show, because I just love interviewing people like you,
yeah.
All the interesting stuff. I get to eat and drink. I mean, I really do enjoy my job. I don't know what I'll do when it ends, but
it is your baby though as well. And I get that, because I was like that on The Big Breakfast. I used to, because they used to always say to me, the producers, "You should really take a holiday." I was like, "I'm not taking a holiday on this job because I know what happens." Rick Adams took a holiday. Kelly Brook took a holiday. And it was like they never came back. I was like, there's no way I'm taking a holiday. I get a little bit like that. I get very territorial about what I'm doing. And I do. It's horrible, isn't it? You just think, I don't want to know if someone else is taking over.
With Pleased to say today's podcast is sponsored by Baroni, fresh frozen pasta now in the freezer aisles in Waitrose. Yes, I did say that. Frozen pasta. It's the same pasta that's used in restaurants around the country. What they do is they cook it al dente and then they immediately freeze it. So it has no additives or preservatives in it. All you have to do is drop it in a pan of boiling water and give it a stir. It's ready to serve in only 30 seconds. This stuff is truly delicious. Thank you for sponsoring the podcast. Apparently, John Peel never took holidays for that reason. And when he did take holidays, he'd pre-record the week's show so that he would never take any time off. When I was at Virgin, I did Virgin Radio for a while on Sundays years ago, and I was exhausted. And so I asked them if I was doing Soccer AM at the same time. So I asked them whether I could take some weeks off, and they got Al Murray to cover for me. And I never went back. Not that I'd lost my job, but I was just too exhausted. And Al, for about 2 years ago, I'm sitting in for Tim Lovejoy. It was really funny. And I'd only done the show for about 2 months and he couldn't carry on. All right, I'm getting on to, you were just mentioning it a minute ago. Next question is, what were you like at school?
I was the class clown. And funnily enough, my daughter's exactly the same. All her school reports are like, she's just constantly mischievous and misbehaving. I wasn't a rude child. I was respectful because I've always had a real fear of, there's always been a level of respect there with me. I mean, I'm still, even with my dad, I'm 47 in May, and there are still things that I wouldn't do in front of my dad. You know, like when I used to get drunk and then I'd have a sneaky cigarette and that, I'd never even tell my dad now because I'd be worried that he'd be disappointed in me. And I'm nearly, I'm like middle-aged, but it's funny. And I was the same at school. I really respected my teachers, but I always tried to turn situations into a bit of banter or fun or do something a bit silly. And I haven't changed, really. I'm the same as I was. And according to my friends, and it was actually the Apperton sisters, from All Saints.
Yeah.
Natalie said to me, because I still see a lot of the girls from my school, and she said, you were always perfect at school. Like, your hair had to be perfect. Your uniform was all... Because I used to iron all my own uniform and get myself ready for school. When I was 11, I used to iron, put all my shirts out for school and do everything myself. I was very independent from a young age.
Yeah, you've got a lot of energy, haven't you? I've worked with you a few times. You've been my co-presenter, and I always think it's not dull when you're around, and you're lively from the minute you walk in, which is unlike me.
Probably a bit annoying. Eddie gets really annoyed with me in the morning. He just said I'm the most annoying person to wake up next to. Because I wake up and I'm like, right, come on up. And I open the blinds and everything. And he wants to wake up slowly. He hates me in the mornings. Yeah. I think until he gets to about 11 a.m. he starts to like me again.
Well, I enjoyed working with you because of the energy, and I think you need that on TV because we have to be slightly exaggerated versions of ourselves on TV.
Yeah.
That's how it has to come across. And working with you, it's like, oh, thank God for that. There's like, it's exciting and I don't know, there's energy going on in the studio. And that's always the thing. Whenever you come on as a guest, it's always the same as well. At least we know there's energy in the studio. You're not going to let a quiet moment happen, are you? You're going to go, let's fill it with some fun.
But you know what happens with me when I come on Sunday brunch? Is it takes me straight back to my big breakfast days, and my innuendo cheekiness just comes out. It only ever happens on your show. Like, I just been on Steph's packed lunch and nothing on that. I did a serious interview, but I don't know if it's because I know you from old or I don't know what it is. I can't help myself. And then afterwards I just think, I've got to grow up. But I just can't grow up.
But then the social media fills up with, oh, I miss the big breakfast, doesn't it? As soon as you've come on the show, because you take everyone back to the big breakfast as well, because you're on live TV again and everyone loves it. So you were just talking about the All Saints there. When I was reading your CV, it said you did backing vocals for Melanie Blatt once, years ago.
No, with Melanie Blatt. I used to sing with a band called The Dread Zone in the early 90s. They were like a techno... electro kind of drum and bassy type band. The guy had really long dreads, and we used to gig for them when I was a teenager. So we were backing singers.
But then you were
on Gary Crowley's The Bee. Do you remember The Bee?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And my dad had no idea that I was singing as a backing singer for Dread Zone. And my mum and dad were watching The Bee, and I was doing a gig at the Astoria. And my mum knew, because I used to obviously tell my mum, but my dad would have flipped because he would have said I was too young to be doing it. I think me and Mel, we got paid like 50 quid cash or something, I remember. And we were like, we're loaded. And I remember my mum saying, my dad was watching, he went, that girl, knife looked like Denise. And my mum went, no, it's not her.
Because
she knew my dad, old Ted from the East End, would go mad. So she said, no, she covered for me.
How old were you then when you were doing that?
I think I was about 15.
Right.
Yeah.
You were in a band as well, weren't you? You were in your own band.
Yes. Though, of course, well, it wasn't really my own band. It was called Those Two Girls. And it was the same. This is how I know Louise Redknapp from old. Because Lou was in Eternal. And the TV, the promoter guy who was looking after them, the music man, was looking to put another girl group together. Because obviously around that time, it was like girl bands were really having their moment, you know. And he saw me in a nightclub and came over to me. I think I was at the WAG or somewhere like that, and said, oh, I want to put you in a girl band. And I thought, you haven't even heard me sing. And actually, I can sing, do you know what I mean? But I thought, so I went along, and I remember my best friend went with me because I said, I've got to go and meet this music producer guy. And I said, I don't want to go on my own. You know, I want to obviously being careful and making sure I'm safe. Will you come with me? And all my friends know what I'm like. I hate being hungry. So whenever I go anywhere, wherever I go, if someone says, oh, when you get there, they might not have any food, or it could be, you could be stuck in traffic, I always take a packed lunch. And I remember we went to his studio, which is obviously where Eternal recorded their album. And she went to me, what have you got in that bag? And I went, I've got a sausage roll. And she was like, why have you packed sausage rolls? And I went, because you don't know. I don't know how long I'm going to be there for. So I turned up, and first of all, Demi said to me, that the guy, he said, oh, can you sing? And I went, yeah, I can sing. I've been at like stage school. And he was like, can you sing for me? And obviously Eternal, which, you know, they were a really credible girl band, and all the music they were churning out. And then I've stood there and I'm saying something like the Jazz Hot or something, like a real proper show tune. And he just went silent, and he went, well, you can obviously sing, and he went, but we won't be recording that one. And then the next thing, he turned around and said to me, because I had this carry bag and I was walking around the studio, I did it everywhere. And he went, what's in the bag? And I went, it's my sausage roll. And he was like, why have you bought sausage rolls? I said, you know, I've spoken to a couple of my friends who've recorded in studios, and they said, sometimes you stay till the early hours in the morning. Honestly, just when I think about it now. But and then I was put with a girl called Kathy, who had already been offered a record deal with Arista Records. But Kathy, they thought, wasn't someone that was like a front person he wanted her to be a solo artist, basically. But the label was saying that they didn't think she'd work on her own because maybe she didn't have the personality or whatever. And they said, if you can put her with someone else, put a group together. So Dennis then had this idea of doing a duo. So he said, oh, I've got this girl I want you to work with. And again, I just thought, sounds a bit of fun. I'm only 18. Do you know what I mean? I'm signing to a major label. So I worked with Kathy, and we did a dance track, and it went to number one in America because it was remixed by Todd Terry.
Wow.
And we were flown over to New York. I mean, I was only 18 at the time. And my life's always full of some sort of drama. We were in Quad Studios the night Tupac got shot.
Mm.
So we were recording in there, and there was all this drama and everything. And anyway, I did this thing with Kathy. The single did really well. Then we ended up doing another follow-up record. And then I got offered, I'd been scouted to do breakfast telly on a Saturday morning for a kids show called Scratchy & Co. And they had a magazine program with it called Massive. So I left the music career behind. And when I went to see Dennis and I was with Kathy, and I felt terrible because I knew that if I left, there was a chance she could lose her record contract. But I thought, well, we've sort of established ourselves a bit, so hopefully they'll keep her on her own. And she got really annoyed with me because obviously I said, it's not for me. I want to go and do, because I never wanted to be a pop star. I was like, I want to go and do, you know, a bit of presenting. And my love was to get back and do a bit of theatre and acting and that. And then I remember Dennis as I was walking out, and he went, this is the biggest mistake of your career, like walking out on this record deal. And I walked out and I went, we'll see. And then I did Massive, and then I got the big breakfast because they spotted me on that. And then I saw him again, and he went to me, I'll take back what I said. You did the right thing by leaving. And I went, I just knew. My gut was just saying to me, The thing with Kathy wasn't my gig, it was hers.
That's amazing. Most people get sort of one opportunity to do something. You've had loads, haven't you? Why is it?
And it's weird because even how I got discovered for presenting, I was on a bus, a 73 bus. I was living in Islington, and this producer called Ben Robinson, who worked at Mentor and Film, spotted me on a bus laughing and joking with the conductor. I actually had my shoe broke jumping onto the bus. And he said to me, I'm doing a casting on Wardour Street at Mentor Films for, we've got an open audition for a Saturday morning kids presenter. Do you want to come? And I went, yeah, go on then. And I went in, did this screen test, then left all my details. And then I got a phone call saying, you've got it.
Do you think you're open to these things? Is that what it is? Do you think you have
I'm very open, Tim.
Yeah, we know about that.
That's how I've got most of my jobs.
I've read that on the internet as well.
I feel I'm very lucky. I'm lucky at times, and I don't know. I think, yeah, maybe. Maybe I'm, without sounding too spiritual, because I'm not that sort of person, maybe I'll throw it out to the universe a bit, and it just, that's why it happens. Because even when I moved to LA, I went to LA for 3 years, and I moved there because my flat got flooded in London, and like completely flooded, and I had to move out. And at the time, I had a big insurance claim going on with Thames Water had flooded it, and they was like going to have to do major repairs, and I'd nowhere to live, and I'd never been to LA. And my friend said to me, I'll go to LA, and I had a couple of mates that were over there and said, just go and have a bit of a holiday while they're doing your flat. And I went, and one night I was in the Chateau Marmont, and I was just chatting to a group of people, and there was a Brit guy there, and he said to me, oh, what are you doing over here? And I said, I'm just basically on holiday. Well, no, people don't say that in LA, do they? They're all actors or screenwriters. And he said, oh, do you want to work? And I went, no, not really. I said, I've just come over to hang out, wanted sunshine. I was feeling a bit fed up at home, split up with my boyfriend, flat's been flooded. My nana just passed away. So I just come here, just literally just to hang out. I'd booked a room in the Sunset Marquee Hotel, and I was there on my own. And he went to me, he said, do you fancy doing, he said, I've got a show. He said, and I'm looking for someone to be a co-presenter on it for NBC. We've got the main guy. And he went, do you want to do it? And I went, what is it? And it basically was the American version of the show I'd done in the UK, the Andrew Lloyd Webber thing, where they cast, they're trying to find people for musicals.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing that for NBC. I didn't even audition for it, nothing. That was literally over a glass of wine in the Chateau Marmont. And I got signed by NBC to a primetime show. And again, I was just thinking, that's a bit weird, isn't it? Like, I literally gone on holiday.
There's got to be something you're putting out, though. There's got to be
what
something.
Is it I'm putting out?
You're always putting out. That's your thing. No,
she just puts out. Maybe that I'm doing an autobiography and I'm trying to find a title for it. Maybe I could just say I'm always putting out.
That's it. Yeah, I put out.
But I don't know. I do think I've been very, very lucky. And sometimes, I'm going to touch wood, I do worry, like we all do, that the luck will run out at some point. But then for all the good things that have happened, I've also had a lot of crappy things as well. It's just I forget the crap because I like to move on from it.
I suppose it's the balls also to take the opportunities. It's a bit about, I mean, you were talking about embarrassing when you were younger. The stuff I did to get on TV, it's so embarrassing. You know, you look back and you go,
did you drop to your knees?
I didn't put out, no. What's the happiest you've ever felt? Could be a moment, could be a year. When is it?
Well, I would say, I mean, obviously, any mother will say after you give birth, it's always quite a wonderful experience and moment. But I would honestly say, and this is going to sound, I feel like I'm the most content I've ever been in my life. And I think I try and see the good and the positive in everything. And I think last year, although it was a really difficult time and continues to be for a lot of people, I really did enjoy just the lockdown experience of just being with my immediate, like with Eddie, with Betsy. I had a great time. I loved it. It's something I've never really done. I was forced to stop and I got a lot out of it.
Yeah, a lot of people have found that being forced to stop has helped them because otherwise they've never done it. Okay, let's move on to the next one really quickly then, which is...
there's too much happiness. Let's get back to the misery.
Yeah, let's do that. What is the key to good relationships? You're discussing Eddie there and stuff and you finally sounds like you found the one. So what is the key to a good relationship? Actually, it could be work or friendships or...
No, I'll go relationship. Well, I've had a lot of boyfriends and they've all been it's proper mixed bag. definitely haven't got a type. I would say laughter. I think that's the thing. We genuinely laugh every day. We've got exactly the same humour. And it's quite rare to find that. And even people that are around us see it. And a lot of my friends don't. I always say it's the one thing when I'm talking to them and their relationship's, you know, going wrong or something. And I'll go, but do you laugh together? And they'll go, well, not really. And I'm like, well, if you haven't got that, it's done as far as I'm concerned. Because all the rest of it, things can be worked on, but that's something you can't put there, the humour and just having the same sense of humour. We don't even have to be speaking and someone could walk past us, we'll be thinking exactly the same thing. And funnily enough, in terms of like friendships, and that's what I had with Johnny on the show, that we were like that. Our brains would think the same thing, which is why I think when we did the big breakfast together, it worked so well. And I've not really had that with people before. Do you know what I mean? It's quite rare when you find that.
Yeah. The next question is, what's it like to be famous? But what's really interesting about that is you are proper famous, because celebrity these days isn't quite. I always say this to Simon when we go to award ceremony. No one's interested in the actual people who are on TV doing comedy or dancing or singing. They're only interested in the reality stars. They've absolutely swamped the world, and they're the celebrity now. When you were famous, I know you're still famous, but during that big breakfast time, and then you were dating JK as well, and he was one of the biggest stars in the world. I mean, your celebrity was huge, wasn't it? What was that like?
Yeah. It was mental. And I used to go to Jay's house and we'd have helicopters flying over his land. He had like 85 acres of land, still got it, he's still in the same place. But there would be helicopters flying over to try and get pictures. Paps literally used to hide in the bushes. It was mental. But again, I never really, I don't see myself as being famous at all. I don't even if I go somewhere, first of all, now I just think people don't know who I am, because I just feel like I was known then. I don't think people really give a toss about me now. But it's just weird when I'll be somewhere and then a mate of mine will walk out of a shop or something and they go, is that weird? And I go, what? When they'll go, when everyone was looking at you. And I'm like, I haven't even noticed it. I don't notice it. Do you notice it? People looking at you?
No, because I live in London. But every now and then I'll see someone trying to take a photo of me or something, and then I go, what are they doing? And then I go, oh yeah, I'm on TV. And I always forget. I'm like you, I forget that sort of thing, because I think in London you can just pretty much
you can. But I don't, the fame thing to me, I'm not fussed by it at all. It doesn't bother me. I mean, I like the jobs that I do.
Yeah,
I wouldn't just do something just because it was going to make me famous. Do you know what I mean? If I wanted like the shock factor or something, then there's no point to it. I like having the substance.
I found it fascinating watching you in the circle, actually, because I knew pretty much everyone who was in the circle, but I thought it's really, everyone knew you, but then it's quite tough, isn't it? Because you have to, celebrities, I don't know, you've got the, I can't remember the reality star now, what was her name, the Geordie one?
Charlotte Crosby,
yeah. And then you had Bag of Chips, and then you had Lady Alicia, and you had all the guys there. And I thought it's really interesting when they bring them all together, they're all going to know who each other are, because it's quite a diverse selection of people.
Looked like
quite good fun to do, was it?
It was. But you know what's a real eye-opener? Because I don't do reality telly. I mean, I've only ever done, I did Strictly before, and obviously I have a little stint on Dancing Ice, but I don't class them as the same.
You voice the biggest reality TV show.
Yeah, but I only voice it, so I'm not on it, you know.
Yeah.
But it is a very different way. Like you and I, we're used to doing the same type of telly. You know, you chat yourself. Like, I don't think I'm any different off telly than I am on telly particularly. Do you know what I mean? I might be a bit cheekier, but it is really interesting watching people do reality, because obviously I couldn't see any of them, and they really play up for the cameras, you know, because they're very camera aware. And I don't think I was ever really, not really like that. Like you can just see like their reaction, like, oh, because they haven't, you know, they've been voted at the bottom or wherever. So I'd go, oh, great. You know what I mean? And it's all really hammy. It's like a pantomime. And I'm like, oh, this is all a bit weird for me, because I'm not used to seeing that. Like,
it worked though, didn't it? I thought everyone came across really well.
Really, really well.
I liked everyone.
It's a really good show.
I think they edited.
Yeah, I suppose they've just grown up in that. But what is really interesting, because I am friends with a few of the reality lot, is they don't have a filter at all, even just you know, I know Lydia really well, Lydia Bright.
Yeah.
And we would go to a pub, we live in Essex, and I'd meet Lydia. Now, I've always been a little bit like, if I am out or somewhere and I'm having a private conversation, I keep my voice very low, don't want people to hear, you know, because you're very aware, aren't you, of people around you. Because the reality lot, because they live their life on camera, they don't, when they're out, they just, they don't care who's listening. Like Lydia would be having conversations, this one talked about years ago, about Arj in a relationship, and be like, Lydia, keep your voice down. You don't know who's listening. Oh, I don't care.
Yeah.
Because they're just so used to being them on camera and on telly.
When you follow reality stars on Instagram, it's just relentless. The amount of stuff, from the minute they wake up, because that's what they're used to, the stories, they're on their Instagram just doing story, story, story. It's absolutely relentless. I mean, I found...
Charlotte Crosby's got something like 7 million followers on Instagram.
Amazing.
Like, it's insane, isn't it? But she was really nice because I've never met her before and I obviously spoke to her afterwards and I really liked her. But I did think, I wonder, see, there's a massive price to pay though for that life, you know? And I don't, that's, I dipped my toe in the water of it, but that being so exposed is not for me.
You've done three of those shows now. You've done The Circle, Strictly, brilliant on Strictly, and Dancing on Ice, where you got injured. I don't know why I'm laughing. I shouldn't be laughing at that.
No, do you know what? I laughed as well because I actually was so rubbish at ice skating that it did me such a favour. Everyone's like, oh, you must be so gutted. You went off the show. And I was like, no, I would have ended up paralysed. It's so dangerous.
That show has had a lot of injuries.
When I had the meeting with the producers and they said, you know, about they're doing the show, and I went, the first question I asked is, if we go into a full lockdown, are we key workers? Can we still work? And they said, yes. I went, I'll do it. And then I went home and I said to Eddie, do you know what? It doesn't matter what happens. If we go into another full lockdown, I can work. Because obviously my ADHD, I've got to be busy.
Right.
And he went, yeah, babe, but have you thought about what you've actually got to do? And I went, I'll be all right. And he went, it's really hard. He said, the things that they expect you to do, it's hard. And I was like, nah, it's fine. How hard could it be? Well, honestly, every time Matt tried to let go of my hand, like, don't leave me, don't leave me, don't leave me. Literally. And I was coming across. I mean, I wouldn't say I hated it because I love the show and I love the experience, but the actual ice skating, I was going to everyone. I love everything about it. I love the studio day. I'm sorry, the dog. I love everything about it, the studio day and all that, but the bit I don't like is the ice skating. And but that's the show.
How's your injury now? How's your shoulder?
Well, it's better than it was. I'm 6 weeks into my recovery of it and I've got another about 6 weeks to go. So I'm doing physio, but I was fractured in three parts and dislocated.
Wow.
So I had a proper heavy fall and it took them, my shoulder was dislocated for 15 hours, which means that it's going to take longer to get better because you really, if you get a dislocation, you should put it straight back in.
Well, why was it? Was it because you try so hard? Is it you're one
it
of these people?
It wasn't the trying hard. I hit a toe pick and I went flying. And do you know what? I felt better about it when I found out that 3 days before the final show, Christopher Dean did exactly the same. And I thought, well, if it can happen to Christopher Dean, Jane and Chris, it can happen to anyone.
Wow.
But he was fine. He's fine. But he had the similar fall that I had. Oh. It's just ice. It's just too slippery. And it's so cold. And the other thing is as well, when we trained, you'd go to an ice rink. And I like to be warm. I'm a summer sunshine person. I'm not really one for the cold. And I'd just be in the ice rink going to Matt, it's so cold. I'm freezing. It's an ice rink. What did you expect? What did you sign up to?
I really wanted to do the jump, but I couldn't arrange it so that I would have had to take a lot of weeks off Sunday brunch. And as I say, I like doing the show, so it wasn't worth doing. But I really wanted to do that because it looked like a lot of fun. But God, so many people got injured on that as well.
So many. I mean, and we had, this is like a record of how many people got injured on this. But yeah, I'd never ice skated before. I've never skied before, so I was learning completely from scratch. And people were surprised by that. And the worst part for me was at the beginning, I was like the bookie's favourite to win because the people going, oh, she's a dancer, she'll be able to do it. But I've never skied before because I've worked since I was a kid in shows and TV and all my contracts always said, you can't take part in any dangerous sports, blah, blah, blah. So I've never tried anything like it before. So yeah, I was an ice virgin and they broke me.
A couple more questions, and this one's my favourite one. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
I've been pinned down by something in the night that I think was, yeah, that I think was a ghost, and I don't know for sure, but this was at JK's house because he lived in a house, big. Oh, for God's sake, Tilly, stop! I'm telling my ghost story. She's consents the spirits. Mm-hmm. Jay's house in the country is quite famous for being known that there's a green lady there that haunts the house. They call her the Green Lady. And I swear one night I got held down in the bed by this green lady, or some sort of force was on top of me, and it wasn't Jay in a big hat. But I don't know if it was a dream, but I remember just waking up, my body being really, really heavy, and I was struggling to get up out of the bed.
Isn't that sleep paralysis, though?
Kind of. But I don't know. I still don't know to this day whether or not it was the Green Lady or just my imagination running wild. But I also used to get this weird thing, because his bedroom, I mean, it's probably changed it now, but his bedroom was this big space with a bathroom, an ensuite. And I used to always feel like someone was watching me from the ensuite. It was really weird. Like, I could feel like eyes watching me. It was bizarre. And not just me that said it, because a couple of my friends came over and stayed, or if he had a party, and we'd go into, like, you know, to touch our makeup up or whatever, and they'd go, oh, and I'd say, what? And they'd go, oh, I thought someone was in the bathroom then. I'm sure I heard something, saw someone. So I don't know if it was the Green Lady.
The Green Lady. Was there any history behind the Green Lady, or it was just someone had seen a Green Lady?
No, I think it was, yeah, there is a history. I can't even remember it now, that she was trapped in the house and died or something. And she was, you know, they say her spirits, they're trying to get out. And sometimes we would hear footsteps as well. He had the floor above where his bedroom is. You could sometimes hear like footsteps or someone running across, and that would be when we'd be in the house on our own. It's very weird. It was quite an old, creepy house. I'm sure he's renovated it now, made it look all super modern, but it was quite creepy.
Spooky. All right, final question. Thank you so much for doing this, Denise. But final question, what is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life is to, enjoy it and spread as much joy as you can. I think that's all you can ask for, and all you can do is just try and spread a little bit of happiness, and don't spread your legs too much.
You had to add that at the end. It was going so well. You know what? You've changed my mind on this podcast. I love doing my podcast because every time I do them with anyone, whether it's the celebrities or the people I'm learning stuff about, I always get my mind changed. And I've decided I'm going to start embracing and saying yes to more things. I'm going to regret it, probably. But I think when people offer me to do things, I'm going to go, yeah, I'll do that just to see, have some fun.
Yeah. I mean, you'll always, like I said, even dancing on ice, I just said yes straight away. And really, I shouldn't have really. But again, I have got something out of it. I met some lovely people, you know, and I had 3 months of training. I can ice skate now. All right, I'm not particularly great, but I can ice skate. So I've learned a new skill.
Can you go backwards?
That's because I said yes.
Can you go backwards?
Yeah. I mean, slowly, but I can. I could go faster if I had someone pulling me along.
Denise, thank you so much for joining me today. Lovely. Always a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I look forward to watching you on Sundays, on Sunday Brunch. You know, it's one of my favourite shows.
Cheers, Denise.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com. Or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.